is Thursday, April 12th at 3:30 p.m. This is session 4315, Navigating the Tigris. Who is really at the helm? Who controls Iraq? My name is Jeffrey Engel. I have the honor of directing the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, and therefore I also have the honor of being your moderator today. For this session, we are going to utilize our first speaker will be Malu Innocent. She is affiliated with the Cato Institute, and she is also a frequent commentator on just about every media outlet you could possibly think of, so I'm sure she looks familiar to you even now. She talks on all the major networks on research, in particular on the Middle East, Afghanistan, and Iraq. She will be followed then by Ross Wilson, who, of course, is an ambassador, and twice ambassador, in fact, first to Turkey and then to Azerbaijan. He is currently a distinguished senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. And last will be Kamal Qureshi, who is director of the United States and Europe's Turkey Project at the Brookings Institution. And his most recent work is Turkey and the West, Fault Lines in a Troubled Alliance. Without any further ado, I will turn it over to Malu for about 10 minutes. Is that okay?
Okay. Hello, everyone. Thank you all for coming. Last month was the 15th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War, an event that is still unfolding. As I will briefly lay out for you today, the question of who controls Iraq is part of a multi-decade quest to militarily defend U.S. interests across the broader Middle East, a quest which sadly has proven to be flawed and, I believe, harmful to our material abundance and to our global leadership position. I'm going to briefly go over some of recent events that led up to the intervention and sort of what that may say for us going forward in the global war on terror. From 1980 to 1988, during the Iran-Iraq War, the United States was arming both sides of the conflict in its desire to see neither side dominate the region. The conflict evolved into a bloody stalemate, with U.S. arms, technology, and intelligence helping Iraq avert a defeat, but eventually grow into a regional power that invaded Kuwait in August 1990, sparking the Persian Gulf War. The U.S. formed an international coalition to oust Saddam from Kuwait, but the U.S. also garrisoned the Persian Gulf and continued its presence in Saudi Arabia, instituting a sanctions regime and enforcing a no-fly zone over Iraq that brought no decisive end to the U.S. military involvement in the region. During that time, Osama bin Laden, who had cut his teeth in the Afghan-Soviet War of the 1980s, was incensed by the continued U.S. presence in Saudi Arabia, which is home to Mecca and Medina, the two holiest sites in Islam. Osama bin Laden, or as I like to call him affectionately, OBL, had learned during the Soviet-Afghan War to lure the great powers into perpetual intervention. Years later, in an interview with Al Jazeera, bin Laden said that his goal was to bleed America to the point of bankruptcy. In the transcript, he said that the Mujahideen fighters did the same thing to the Soviet Union, using guerrilla warfare tactics and protracted war of attrition to lure a great power into conflict. He also said, quote, "All that we have to do is to send two Mujahideen to the furthest point east to raise a piece of cloth on which is written Al-Qaeda in order to make generals race there to cause America to suffer human, economic, and political losses without their achieving anything of note," unquote. As Osama bin Laden and his number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, were strategizing about the near and the far enemies, 1997 saw the creation of a Washington, D.C. think tank called the Project for the New American Century, which was created with the goal of promoting American global leadership and openly advocated America's total global military domination. Many of its members would later be staffed in the Bush White House: Donald Rumsfeld, John Bolton, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Dick Cheney, Zalmay Khalilzad, Richard Armitage, and others. In open letters to President Bill Clinton and the GOP congressional leaders, in 1988, the group openly advocated unilateral U.S. action against Iraq and called for the removal of Saddam Hussein's regime from power. After the 9/11 attacks, the worst attacks in U.S. history, terrorist attacks in U.S. history, President Bush, in his 2002 State of the Union address, placed Iraq on his axis of evil. In the six-month period before the war began, over 90% of the 414 stories about Iraq originated from the State Department, the Pentagon, and the White House, that according to the Columbia Journalism Review. As opposed to today, Iraq at this time dominated front pages, magazine covers, news broadcasts, and cable news channels, with the U.S. military invasion and occupation conducted on the basis that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11 and was allied with al-Qaeda. In February 2002, shortly after the Axis of Evil speech, Ken Edelman, a Reagan policy official who served on the Defense Policy Board in the Bush White House, wrote in the magazines of the Washington Post, said, quote, "I believe demolishing Hussein's military power and liberating Iraq would be a cakewalk," unquote. He concluded his piece by arguing that, quote, "measured by any cost-benefit analysis, such an operation would constitute the greatest victory in America's war on terrorism." Years later, in Vanity Fair, Ken Edelman regretted urging military action in Iraq, saying he had overestimated the abilities of the Bush administration and that Bush's national security team was, quote, "the most incompetent teams in the post-war era."
Easy.
And as Peter Van Buren, a State Department Foreign Service officer who served as a team leader for two provincial reconstruction teams in Iraq, the war, quote, "may yet be seen as the single worst foreign policy decision in American history." The post-invasion chaos led to massive social displacement, internal instability, and shattering all order. We also took our eye off Osama bin Laden and the unfolding radicalism in Afghanistan and Pakistan. After the collapse of state authority in Iraq and the ensuing security vacuum, Iraq's surrounding external actors intervened, seeing an opportunity to exploit the chaos and fund various militia groups. The intervention contributed to the diminution of American military power and moral capital by imprisoning people without due process and creating a worldwide detention and interrogation regime beyond the reach of our justice system. The invasion and post-combat occupation increased the number and geographic dispersion of terrorists around the world, and after de-Ba'athification, exacerbated Shia-Sunni tensions and helped consolidate Shiite control of political power, leaving Sunnis disaffected and rebellious, with a sectarian war that spread to Syria and helped lead to the creation of ISIS. The war, sadly, has also attracted thousands of foreign fighters who would later launch international attacks in Paris, London, and Brussels. In conclusion, the total cost of the war has now totaled up to $1.6 trillion of taxpayer money, untold trillions more in long-term veterans care, contributed to the deaths of over 4,500 U.S. soldiers, 32,000 more injured, and at least 150,000 on the low-end estimate of innocent Iraqis killed, millions more internally displaced, and refugees burdening neighboring Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. I'll leave you with these questions. What were we trying to do? What were we trying to accomplish? Who is responsible for this checkered record? What have we gotten in return? Iraq was not merely a problem of operational planning and execution, but of underlying assumptions embedded within the policy. Neither major political party, Democratic or Republican, can come to grips with the conventional wisdom that demands that America do the impossible because America is exceptional. It's the idea that we have the wisdom, the foresight, the sophisticated weaponry, and the capability to shape foreign societies. It's a self-loving vision. What the Iraq War should have taught all of us is that while America is certainly exceptional, America is not infallible. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ambassador Wilson, I would offer you your 10 minutes, sir.
Great. Thank you very much. It's interesting that after all these years, there's still a sizable group of people who are willing to endure a conversation about Iraq. So thank you for being here. One of the things I did in preparing for this was I got out the map. I served in this part of the world, but I kind of wanted to be sure I knew exactly where the Tigris goes. It starts in Turkey. It actually goes through Syria, a little piece of far eastern Syria before it enters into Iraq and subsequently joins up with the Euphrates River that comes further from the west, the cradle of civilization, Mesopotamia. For, I think, the reasons that Malou has described quite eloquently, kind of the cradle of conflict and instability and trouble. In the region in general and for the United States in particular. In the 3 years that I served in Iraq, no issue was more difficult or demanded more time than this one. There's a long story, and we can get into some of that history if it's interesting. But what I want to do in my remarks really is focus a little bit on kind of where we are now. and the policy problem that the United States faces today, and where we go from here. So the picture today, kind of briefly and superficially, the Iraqi government that was installed in 2014, led by Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, has proven to be more effective and quite significantly less contentious than his predecessor, Nouri al-Maliki. In that context, the Sunni-Shia conflict that was so prominent in Iraq has been diminished somewhat. The Kurdish-Arab conflict, although that's not quite the right word, has been diminished quite significantly as a result of the failure of the Kurds' referendum on independence, or not with the failure, but the failed political process that lay behind it. The Arab presence in Iraq, the presence of countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and others, has gone up. The engagement of Iraq's Arab neighbors has increased. ISIS has not completely, I think, but largely been driven out of Iraq, and is certainly a much less important factor there than it was just a couple of years ago. And Iraq's economy has started to rebound a little bit. Its energy sector has started to rebound a little bit. Not bad. Iraq is poised for parliamentary elections on May 12. Turmoil and uncertainty has followed each of the last elections, with a very long period required to form a new government. What happens will probably depend in part on just how Abadi's peace in the politicking succeeds, the extent to which it succeeds, what happens to Maliki, what happens to some of the other players. In short, though, Iraq is now today not the exporter of instability that it was just a few years ago. I wouldn't say that it's a source of stability yet, but clearly is a lot better off. Fragile, incomplete, but less a source of problems. Syria, through which the Tigris flows, not explicitly on the agenda, but absolutely is a factor, and I want to just touch a little bit on that. Assad clearly has regained large swaths of territory, seems poised to gain control of much, if not all, of the rest of Syria over time. The outlook, however, in that country is that Syria will remain weak, isolated, poor, dependent on Iran and Russia, and a source of instability in the region, and in particular as it pertains to the future of Syria. And that, I think, is something to bear in mind as one thinks about the future and what's likely to transpire. So turn to the U.S. policy piece. What would we like now, given all the history, given the limitations on America's ability to influence events that Balu referred to, given what is clearly the president administration's disinterest in that part of the world in general and in Iraq in particular, what are reasonable outcomes that the United States would like to see? And I thought of three items. First, that it not be a base of terrorism that we have to worry about for the United States, or that Iraq's neighbors have particularly to worry about. This is ISIS. This is remnants of al-Qaeda that may exist there, and remnants of those two organizations that could get traction again in Iraq if those Sunni-Shia tensions kind of come back to the fore, if the fragile political process post-parliamentary elections kind of goes a cropper again. Anyway, not a base of terror. Second, that Iraq be reasonably tranquil. And third, that it not be a place of overly embedded Iran. Our ability to affect Iranian influence there is quite limited, although it's not entirely insignificant. What are our tools to promote those kinds of ends? If you agree, to the extent you agree, those are reasonable goals for American policy. a lot of it's diplomatic. It's not big ticket items. It's trillions, billions or trillions of dollars. They have plenty of money. It's in the ground in the form of oil. But it is steady American diplomacy. So diplomacy post-elections to help to facilitate the formation of a new government, and especially to encourage the new government to deal sensibly with these Sunni-Shia divisions that remain in the country. And here we'll be pushing, I think, on a potentially open door. Most of the important electoral alliances in the context of the campaigning that are going on now are multi-sectarian, I'm not sure what the right word is, groupings. They include Sunnis and they include Shia. Several of the important groups, most of the important groups cross that sectarian line and at least provide a kernel on which some American activism in Baghdad and what we can do with the leaders there will be important. Second, continue the kinetic activities to ensure that ISIS doesn't come back. Where it's necessary to do so, I think both in Iraq and Syria, the battle is largely won. Airstrikes alone won't complete it. The Syrian Kurdish peace has gotten a lot more complicated. Kamal might want to elaborate on that later. But nevertheless, carry out sufficient kinetic activity and help to orchestrate sufficient kinetic activity against ISIS and al-Qaeda that they do not become important again. Continue to work on the Kurdish peace. That's the other political part that goes along with the Sunni-Shia peace, to keep the Iraqi Kurds focused on Baghdad and on Iraq's territorial integrity and solving their problems in an Iraqi context, not in a strictly Kurdish one. There, too, we may be pushing on a relatively open door, but an active American role there will remain important. So Sunni, Shia, Kurds, the ISIS piece, the fourth, the economy and energy, promoting and working on behalf of Iraqi economic reform and opening of its markets, liberalization of its economy, trade, investment, and the work that we can promote by the international financial institutions, all kind of real important. It's not American money. It's American engagement and mobilization of the resources of the IFIs. And last, where we can, seek to deter or at least minimize the Iranian role, which first and foremost will be a function of a large and visible American presence, diplomatic presence. Our ambassador, we do actually have an ambassador still, active and out there and giving providing some space to a body who is close to the Iranians but doesn't want to be in their pocket. We need to work closely with the Saudis, with the Egyptians, with the Turks, with the Europeans, as I noted earlier, with the IFIs and the United Nations. We have to finish this task. It isn't a question of money. It isn't a question of large numbers of American troops, or really, for the most part, any American troops, except insofar as the air campaign continues against ISIS. Walking away from this problem, whether it was a good thing that we created it or not, it exists. Walking away from it will be a setback for the region and for American interests there.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Let me please just take a moment to remind you that the app is open. So please submit any questions that you have. We'd love to have them. And now we're going to enjoy hearing from our third speaker. 10 minutes for Kamal, please.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, but I'm in a state of panic because whatever notes I've taken this morning in preparation for this panel has been hijacked by Malu and worse by the ambassador, good friend Ross. The way I'm going to try to make this somewhat interesting to you is to argue that Iraq, unfortunately, has had a deep governance problem. From the day in 1958, when a group of leftist-oriented Soviet sympathizer officers raided the royal family, chased the king of Iraq, Faisal, who would be related to the king of Jordan today, chased him down the streets of Baghdad and butchered him. Together, they also butchered his prime minister, Nuri Said, who was at one point an Ottoman notable. This is all happening in 1958, a long time away. Without understanding the trauma that this impacted on Iraq, part and parcel of similar traumas that took place in Egypt in 1952-54, when the free officers came to power and overthrew the monarchy. Don't think that I'm a royalist, and I've always empathized Nasser there, but at least the Egyptians had the decency of telling their king to board his yacht, take as much as wealth as he could, and then sail into the sunset in the Mediterranean. I always thought that that says a lot about the difference between Egypt and Iraq. Not that Egypt doesn't have its problems. From then on, what happened in Iraq is the gradual arrival to power, a personality that I'm sure you're all familiar with called Saddam Hussein. And at the head of a party that was known as the Ba'athists, committed not to necessarily Iraq, but to unifying the Arab world to overcome what the Western legacy had left in the Middle East, a divided Arab world. With that ambition in front of him, he put into place a system of government that was very much dominated by the Sunni Arabs that constitute about less than a fourth of the population of Iraq. I'll come back to the significance of this and the big challenge that Iraq has ahead of it, though I agree with the slightly promising picture that Ross just drew. The system was one where Saddam Hussein would run elections, but those elections he would always win 99.9% and occasionally 98.99%. And that system was very hierarchical, very repressive, with very little room, public room left for the huge majority, the Shia Arabs that lived mostly southern part of Iraq from Baghdad. The Kurds would put up their resistance and sometimes manage to get some autonomy from Baghdad. You have to also give him some credit that Iraq did have a whiff of stability and prosperity in the 1970s, thanks partly to the oil, but thanks also to that stability which came at some price. But all that collapsed once Saddam Hussein went on to an ambition to capture parts of Iran and overthrow the regime there. I won't go into the details, and that brought us almost a decade-long war, followed by Father Bush's intervention, which then brought the 1990s from where Malou picked up the flag, if I may say. So I won't go into the details of it. Malou, I think, also did a great, very critical and courageous, I thought, reflection on the American intervention there. She made me think of Paul Wolfowitz's visit to Istanbul in late 2002, at, I think, the Hilton or the Conrad, the American consulate had arranged the a conference room there. And most of us were, dare I say, herded into this conference hall. There were lots of academics, lots of leading columnists, business people, and in horror, we listened to Paul Wolfowitz. He had made his mind, and there was no way he was going to change it, even though what we thought we were sharing some wisdom to discourage him from what he set out. Be that as it may, the intention was a grandiose intention to democratize Iraq. We came through the history that was covered by Malou, and I'd like just to make one very quick observation where we stand today. I shared Ross's analysis. I shared his bit of optimism. That bit of optimism is embedded in the current prime minister of Iraq, Abadi, because though he is a Shiite, he is blessed with the political will to want to transcend the sectarianism that was part of Iraq under Saddam Hussein, but got even further aggravated through the 2000s with the Islamic State and the subsequent events that that occurred, but also with the arrival of Shia militias that have been injected into Iraq primarily by Iran. His predecessor, Maliki, had a very different position and has been recognized as someone who aggravated this sectarianism. But today, we have an Iraq that is dominated by the Arab Shiite. And the challenge they have ahead of them is to make sure that they do not replicate the mistake that was injected into the Iraqi system all the way back in 1958. And it is a challenge that ought not be taken lightly. And Abadi recognizes it. And as Ross has flagged out, not the whole of the Shiite political scene, let alone the theological scene or the Ayatollahs, are the foot soldiers of Iran. The best role that I see for the United States here is to encourage and give the political clout that Abadi deserves and hopefully emerges from the upcoming parliamentary elections as again the next prime minister. And what will need to be done in Iraq, and I have my little doubts as to how far the neighboring countries are going to play a constructive role in that, is to weave into place a governance system that recognizes Iraq's wealth, its diversity, not just its oil, but its diversity that has its roots in the opening lines of Ross when he recalled the Mesopotamia, Iraq, as the cradle of civilization. But that's going to be a long trip, and maybe it also relates to the panel that we are going to participate in with Ross tomorrow that is going to speculate whether we can begin to see peace and stability in the broader Middle East. But I invite you to go back and dig up The Economist of about 2-3 weeks ago. There is an optimistic piece there, an optimistic piece that we've tried to capture here, but there are challenges too. I'm running out of my time. I'd like to share very quickly some of the challenges I see, leaving aside the ones that Ross has already made references to. One technical challenge will be how to integrate the Shia militias that played a central role in in pushing ISIS out of Mosul at the price of the destruction that was caused. Return of the displaced, Malu mentioned more than 3.5 million people, and mostly Sunni Arabs, have been displaced, and their homes need to be reconstructed. And then there are those little minorities that enrich Iraq's identity that need to be reconstituted and, if possible, brought back, including the Yazidis. And finally, the big project, making sure that the governance system that is put into place is representative of that diversity. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for those three stimulating and fascinating presentations. And also, I want to thank the audience immediately for their series of questions that have flowed in, which I think is testament to the provocative and thoughtful nature of your presentations. I'm going to turn to those questions, but first, as a historian, I feel obliged to tell an anecdote of my own, which is, since you began in 1958, I'm going to begin in 1956 with a wonderful letter that I found at the Eisenhower Library from John Foster Dulles to President Eisenhower, dated January 1st, 1956. This is, of course, right before Eisenhower would go on to win a second term at the end of the year. And in it, Dulles laid out the diplomatic agenda, if you will, for the administration. Down the list, about number 8, was, I think this year we can solve the Middle East. So if nothing else, I look forward to joining you at the 170th anniversary of this conference to continue this discussion. But without further ado, let me turn to the speakers, questions from our students. And many are very provocative, so I will warn you ahead of time. I'm going to begin with this one. Ambassador Wilson, what are the hurdles to implementing the diplomatic push in Iraq that you are advocating, and how might the U.S. overcome these challenges? And I'm going to add an addendum to that. Do you see interest at the highest level of the United States government in overcoming those challenges?
There aren't big impediments in the way of that diplomacy. As I noted, we have an ambassador in Baghdad. He was my deputy when I was in Ankara, a very capable diplomat. He's kind of operating in a vacuum. There is no Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East. Mm-hmm. It's an acting retiree brought back to kind of fill the bench. There is Under Secretary of State above him in the pantheon, who has about 8 million problems to deal with, and Iraq at best is probably number 7,900,000. We have no Secretary of State. We're not going to have one for a while, and there are many other issues and problems that command his attention. In diplomacy, and of course, we don't have an aid budget, or we maybe have a little bit of an aid budget for Iraq, and money isn't really the main issue. But in diplomacy, sometimes one of the things you have is time, the currency of time. I worked a number of years ago for Robert Zoellick when he was Deputy Secretary of State and was charged with working the Darfur issue in Sudan. Very painful, terrible genocide being carried out against the Darfur people by the Sudanese government. And how are we going to solve this thing? He had no money to deal with. He had no inclination by the U.S. military to go in and do anything. We were already pretty well tied up in Afghanistan and Iraq. There was little we could propose at the United Nations. And, oh, by the way, the International Criminal Court had an indictment out against the president of the country. So how do you work your way around these problems? And what do you work with? Well, what he worked with was a vice president of Sudan who he met with, who didn't have blood on his hands as far as we could tell, repeatedly offering up his time, Zoellick's time, the number two guy at the State Department, time. And that's basically what we'll have to do with Iraq. Some time, not a lot, by some senior people in Washington, being there, being present, being on the ground from time to time, engaging with these Iraqi leaders, hosting Abadi in Washington, hosting whoever the new Iraqi foreign minister in Washington. It's not about time. It's not about money or military men, although some of those things may be necessary at some point. It's about personal engagement where we can accomplish a lot.
Thank you. Would either of you like to comment on that as well? You don't have to.
I would say ditto. Personal engagement is very critical. In spite of the legacy of the U.S. In Iraq, I think many out there, to your surprise, does look up to the United States. But it's important to have that will and to mobilize that that time and to give the attention if you don't want the villains to sneak in.
Right, and I would agree. I think my one sad reaction to this, and this is sort of the tragedy of this policy, is that I find that we're often reacting to the aftermath of these crises and not able to address the underlying issues, and that's why I'm happy that you went to the 1950s and I went to the 1980s, and we can understand that this. We often think of these policies and these reactions as distinct from one another. It's only when we put them together and understand that this is part of a long interconnected involvement that this is why it requires time and patience and dedication, but oftentimes we're so reactive to the events of the day that we're not able to give the time that's necessary to address the underlying problems.
Thank you. Well, Malou, let me pick up on that thought and comment with a question from a student that is derived from your presentation. I was particularly impressed in your presentation by the forceful argument that we need to both learn from history but also to use history to avoid hubris, to think that we know the answers and know what the future will bring no matter how much we study the past. So with that in mind, let me turn to a student question for you, though I would encourage the others to think I'm going to turn to you next with this. Is there anything to be gained should President Trump decide to attack Syria in the name of stabilization in the region? What effects do you see this having on Iraq's fragile stability? It's a student question, so I can give them a bad grade.
The only reason I hesitate is I don't find what could be gained. Dislodging a dictator, obviously, dislodging a butcher. But I can't imagine that it would bring a great deal in terms of U.S. power, U.S. prestige. I just get the sense that the Middle East is a vortex. It's almost, or I guess, pardon the analogy, but a quicksand. Mm-hmm. The more we try to pull ourselves out, the more we get pulled in. I don't want to be flippant about this answer, but I just don't see a great deal that can be gained. Of course, we want to do everything we can to dislodge the conditions under which we see human rights being abused, the rights of foreign people being abused, the people being killed as a result of chemical warfare. But I do get the sense that this is just, it can be an opening in another broader front in the global war on terror. And again, let's not think of these as interventions as distinct. This is part of a broader campaign, whether that be Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, Pakistan, sub-Saharan Africa for that matter. So it's easy for us to look at these policies very distinctly, but they are part of a broader interconnected foreign policy, and we must step back and understand that we cannot be hubris about this. I think oftentimes because of our hubris, we think that we can put on a lot on our shoulders. If anything, I think sometimes it can expose our weaknesses.
Mr. Ambassador?
I don't agree with don't disagree with anything Malou said. I'll state things more simply on my own behalf. I think that an attack on Syria in retaliation for this chemical weapons activity by Syrian forces seriously risks a substantial widening of the war, especially if Iran and Russia respond. Russia has already indicated that it would. That will be bad for Iraq and for Iraq's prospects in keeping this tenuous balance that improved things modestly over the last year and a half or so. It'll make it much, much harder and increase tremendously the pressure on Abadi to kowtow to the Iranians.
So it's much more eloquently.
Do you want to jump in?
It's a very unfair question because it's a very tough question.
Yes.
And I hope the student doesn't grow up to become a professor and throw such difficult questions to his or her students. I agree with what has been said. This one is a difficult one. I think Syria, as well as what happened in Iraq, are manifestations of a rule-based order that was woven into place after the Second World War. And it did work for a good while. And I think we have entered a period in the last 5-6 years where that order is deeply strained, if there are still any elements of it there. And when a rule-based order collapses, what follows is rule of the jungle, or the famous Thomas Hobbesian world. And Ambassador, I don't want to shock you, but what happened last year in April, when again chemical weapons was used, and there was a surgical hit on a Syrian airbase, but it came at a lightning, like a lightning rod, without too much pondering about it. I would argue that that strike did have positive repercussions. It did implant the thought in Assad, and I think in Russians, as well as in Iranians, that there is a price attached to crossing that red line, even if it is not at the level that once the international community expected back in 2012 or 13. And then the impact of that lightning rod fizzles away, weakens, and then you see the butchery that we've seen in Ghouta, eastern Ghouta, and then Douma later on. And there will be more to come. I'm not someone that can look into that crystal ball. I can't make such claims. But I and a lot of people who are following what's going on in Syria is very worried about Idlib and what Assad is planning or will be doing in Idlib. If this chemical weapon case goes unpunished, unpenalized, I wonder what will follow. However, it will be very critical that it is established unequivocally that it is indeed the Syrian regime that did it.
Well, let me follow up on that, because and to combine all three of these points, if one of your contentions, therefore, is that the surgical strike last year essentially worked as a vaccine, if you will, to keep chemical weapons from being used for a year. Vaccines wear off, I think, is part of your point. Consequently, is there a large enough dose that could be given to prevent or to preclude the Syrian regime from going down and crossing that international norm, knowing, as Malou pointed out, that there really is no American strategy here short of regime change, and I do not think that we want to presume we do not want to launch a large enough strike to actually achieve that. So what is the middle ground? Where is the number that we should be using?
It must not drift into what Malou said, hubris. To me, it must remain surgical.
Oh, the mic.
It must remain surgical, but then behind the scenes, the diplomacy must be fielded energetically, whereas Ross has just described the state that this grand Department of State is in. And we are going, not just in the U.S., but in some other countries as well, including in Turkey, where the professionals, the diplomats, have been shunted away. Whereas we know from literature and from observing, from the discussions and the debates that are taking place, Russia is concerned about Syria as well. And Russia recognizes, Putin recognizes that he's not going to be able to solve Syria on his own steam. He has to look over his shoulder. Iran may be doing the dirty work for him on the ground, but he has to make sure that Iran doesn't cross the balance, the line, and change the equilibrium in Syria. And he has to worry about the cost of Syria for his leadership, but also for Russia at large in the economic sense of the word. And I do also recognize that between Iran, Russia, and Turkey, they have put into place this Astana process with its pluses and minuses. And this is why a strategy is important, and this is why I think Ross underlines the significance of a strategy. And that strategy will only be thought of and developed if diplomats and professionals are engaged. And I can't afford to say this, but I'll still say it, that you don't try to lead the world using Twitter. You know.
No, I believe you're actually supposed to use Facebook. Mr. Ambassador, let me couple different questions that have come in and put you on the spot with this one, which is to think about the large territorial integrity of Iraq. Several people and several students in particular have wondered about the feasibility of an independent Kurdish state and, of course, whether or not the United States should support that in fact or at least in rhetoric.
So we talked about this some in an earlier session that dealt with separatism. But just to repeat some of that, it's been United States policy since long before we went into Iraq that we support its sovereignty, its territorial integrity, its independence, it within its existing boundaries, and that it has never been a matter of policy that we would support the establishment of an independent Kurdish state. There are a variety of reasons for that, including having to do with precedents that sets for other parts of the world, which if you sort of get going in the separatism game can become, including especially in the Middle East, a bloodbath that makes what's happened over the last couple of decades in that area, in that region look like a walk in the park. I think the sensible thing and what the wicket that we have been on is to encourage the Iraqi Kurds to work within the existing context of Iraq. There is a substantial amount of Iraqi nationalism, some of which is anti-Iranian character, notwithstanding the Shia majority of the country. There's a lot to work with there. Anyway, if we love the violence and turmoil the country has experienced, we will love it even more. When there's a move to establish an independent state in northern Iraq, or for that matter, in northern Syria.
One of the few surviving elements of that rule-based order is what the ambassador was referring to, the territorial integrity, respecting the territorial integrity of existing states, but then making sure that you put into place a governance model that addresses the aspirations, the interests of minorities. And I recognize that here in the United States and in Europe, there has always been a deep affection for Kurds. They deserve it. But then, at what price are you going to support separatism, the way Ross just mentioned it? And whose separatism? which Kurds are going to lead that separatism? Washington Post, New York Times regularly talks about Syrian Kurds. I happen to be an academic that's very critical of the Turkish government's policies internally, externally. But in one area, you have to give the man some recognition, some credit. He is fighting a group of Syrian Kurds that are committed to a particular ideology, rightly or wrongly. And because they are particularly committed to one ideology, they are not allowing Kurds from Kobane, who are sitting right across Kobane on the Turkish side of the border, in refugee camps, because they are not the right Kurds. This is why I think it's going to be so much more important to address these challenges within existing borders, rather than stick the stick into the beehive and make things even worse. And this is why I am genuinely optimistic about Iraq, because if Iraq manages to shed the legacy of what happened in 1958 and what followed, and manages with primarily internal dynamics, but also with support from the international community to put into a model there gradually, it will take a very long time to address the interests and the aspirations of the Kurds within the Iraqi border and other minorities, I think we can begin to be hopeful about the future of the Middle East.
Let me ask you to put on your long-range thinking caps for this question, really long-range, or even long-range going back, and combine a couple of fascinating questions that have come in, particularly from students, which couple long-range trends. The first is if you could comment on the impact of environmental change on these conflicts and where that would lead in the future. And I would encourage you, in fact, to go across to Pakistan, across to further away from just the Tigris. But secondly, and this is a particularly fascinating question, given the world's decreasing interest or need in Middle Eastern oil, what is the effect of that economic and industrial change upon the potential stabilization of the region? And please don't limit yourself to Iraq.
Do you want to go first?
we talked about it, Ross, and you had some great ideas.
As well as some fascinating
thank you. Stats.
Thank you.
So why don't we throw you at the fire?
Well, on the first, I'm not a great expert in climate change or in what's taken place in the broader region. I do know that the revolt in Syria began in the southern part of the country, which had undergone 2 years of intense drought, created all kinds of economic, social, political, and other problems. That when the match of the Arab awakening gets struck and finally makes its way to Syria, the kindling is all in that southern part of the country, and in fact, Syria as a whole had undergone a very substantial drought for a period. The south was the most intense. Others may know more about the broader region. On energy, this is a complicated one. There is today in the world a relative glut of energy on the world market that owes to a variety of things, but perhaps first and foremost to a radical increase in American oil production, like a doubling over the course of the last 6 or 7 years. And one of the interesting things that's taken place in that period is we have gone, since 2000, roughly 2005, from importing 60% of our oil, a share that I at least thought was probably going to go on forever, if not go up, to about 15% today. And it will go down in the years to come as more increases in American production go up, and energy efficiency and some of the new technologies that were discussed earlier in this conference really start to come on stream. So we're going to become significantly less dependent on Middle Eastern oil, which I think now is around 3 or 4% of our total consumption. However, and so you know, and the world generally is going to need maybe somewhat less oil. Maybe it needs somewhat less Middle Eastern oil. But there are a couple of other pieces that sort of work in a different direction. One is that prices for oil are set globally, and if there is, let's say that share of global energy supplies that comes out of the Middle East, if that were to decrease by, say, 15 or 20%, that's going to have a dramatic impact on world energy prices, and that will in turn have a dramatic impact on us. So we care about the stability of Middle Eastern oil production, even though we maybe need a little bit less of it. Second, you still need oil. I mean, even if all those great things, a number of us were at that first session, the clean energy and how cars are going away, and, you know, maybe that guy's right. I don't know. We're still going to need a lot of oil because there isn't actually an obvious substitute for the petrochemical industry, which is big business on which major sectors of our economy depend. There isn't an obvious alternative to oil. In heavy-duty transport, I think it's going to be a long time before solar or electric battery-powered vehicles are big in the long-haul truck business or in the overseas shipping business. Oil is going to dominate in that sector. So oil is going to be, is going to remain real important for us, and the stakes for American prosperity and welfare in the Middle East, and specifically in the Middle East oil energy sector, have not gone down, are not going down at all, even though the political imperative and I think especially the political support for large-scale American involvement will get more complicated. One interesting piece to watch will be China, which imports, I don't know what the percentage is, a very large percent of its energy, and most of it comes from the Middle East. Will China become a stakeholder on issues of Middle East peace and security? And how will that work? How will we feel about that? What kinds of things will the Chinese want? I think that's a space to watch also that's quite interesting.
I'm not an expert on the environment, neither on the energy, but I am aware that Middle Eastern leaders, and especially someone called Mohammed bin Salman, the Prince Crown of Saudi Arabia, is fixated on this issue. Diversification of the economy. And what drives this, let's call it obsession with the need to diversify the economy, I think is recognition that the world energy scene is changing. If this does indeed happen, and in that sense, I'm hopeful about Iraq too, if there is diversification in the Middle East or in oil and gas producing, energy producing Middle Eastern countries, is that this will weaken the notion of rentier state. One of the few contributions that Middle Eastern studies has made to political science from my humble point of view is this concept of rentier state, and associating the notion of rentier state to why democracy is not taking root in those countries. The fact that the elite in a state controls the source of income or the what generates income and then can distribute the income to its citizens and maintain their loyalty. I think there's a recognition that there are limits to it, and one place may well be Iraq. We will see how this is going to play out in the coming, not years, but at least decades.
I've always been skeptical of the notion that the overarching motivation of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East is only and merely to protect oil, or that it was for Halliburton or any of these sort of conspiratorial ideas. But it is true to say in one respect that after the hostage crisis in Iran in 1979, that the Carter Doctrine was promulgated, in which the United States stated for the first time ever that it was in its interest to protect the Persian Gulf era resources and to protect the sea lines of communication in that region. That will certainly no longer be one of the motivating factors in U.S. foreign policy. So as that gradually declines, then we must ask again, what would be the overarching motivation for the United States to remain in the region, whether that be to disrupt terrorist cells, whether that be to, in some ways, enhance or control stability to ensure that events don't spin out of control. But as we see the gradual undermining of the oil doctrine, of the oil idea, then we're certainly going to see that one, at least one plank of U.S. foreign policy in the region be undermined. And also, I think this will enormously impact Iraq. It's, I believe, after Saudi Arabia, it's the second largest OPEC oil producer. And so certainly it would be impactful to Iraqi economic interests. And I think from what I understand in terms of the lead up to the May elections, much of the Iraqi civilians, what they'd like to see is a more inclusive government, a more accountable government, and one that tries to eradicate the corruption as a result of the rents that have been brought on from the oil wealth. So we'll see if that continues to be a problem. Oh, no, in the environmental issue, I'm not an environmentalist or anything.
Well, I'm going to, don't worry, I got another question for you, which is, in particular, you gave a very insightful litany of, shall we say, prophetic offenders with the enthusiasm for the Iraq War in 2003, describing, of course, in great detail how all of their predictions proved to be, shall we say, wrong. One of the key prognosticators in that vein has just been named National Security Advisor. I was hoping you could comment on that.
The walrus. No, just kidding. Mr. Bolton, I have not met him, but I have read him extensively. I think that he is someone who loves American power, and I think he believes so much in America's ability to reshape world events that he has not seen a country or a war that he hasn't liked to, you know, start conflict with, whether that be Libya, North Korea, Iraq, Iran, just go down the list. I think that him and many of the other signatories to the Project for the New American Century, again, I'm not totally in line with this idea that it's a conspiratorial type of idea. I think it's more that they truly believed that it was the end of history with the America's unipolar moment and the fall of the Soviet Union, that it was America's turn as a unipolar power to reshape global events to American interests. I think that someone like Bolton still believes in that mentality, even as we've seen the gradual weakening of America's alliances, not only because of the diplomatic reasons that Ross had laid out, but also because of the rule-based order that Kamal has explained as well. And I think that's something that is, we still operate in the same mentality. And I think there's something to be said about the Beltway bubble.
So we have time for one more question, which I'm going to pose to all three of you. I'll let you answer in the order that the answer comes to you. Our current commander-in-chief is many things, but he is not particularly known for his attention span. If you had the president's ear, or more accurately, his Twitter feed, what would you insert in his Twitter feed at this particular moment to resolve what you consider to be the most critical aspect of Middle Eastern policy? And Twitter has expanded, so you get more than 140 characters. But what's a piece of advice you would like him to know?
I'd say turn the damn thing off. I'm sure it's
a very good one.
Yeah.
Very good one. Very good one.
Yeah, that is pretty good. go with your gut. You know, originally you believed that the Iraq War was wrong, and if true, if you truly did believe that at the time and wasn't just doing that opportunistically during the 2016 campaign, go with your gut in that respect. Be more humble in terms of America wielding its stick around the world. We must be more skeptical about our ability to reshape foreign societies and foreign events.
I'll take the fifth on that.
Okay, so if for those of you keeping score, the answer was don't tweet, be humble, and lawyer up.
That's right.
Okay. I think that's a good place to stop. Thank you all for joining us for this session.